He is a graduate of Princeton University, on the board of directors of the Roper Public Opinion Center at Williams College. He serves also as president of the poll I've mentioned since 1966. He's the author of many books and articles, including the Public Opinion Referendum. Mr. Gallup has appeared on countless programs overseas, BBC, and all over. It is my great privilege, I think privilege of Dutchess Community College, for me today to introduce to you and present George Gallup.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sheen. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to be here. This is certainly a very exciting day for all of America, this D-Day. This is going to be a very, very important day in two basic respects. Not only because many people feel that there is no difference between the two candidates in certain issues, and the public wants clarification on the issues, but also because the debates may have a very important effect of igniting voter interest, which is seriously lagging at the present time. As a matter of fact, we find that only about half of young people are registered at the present time. Thus far, it looks as if we're going to have another record low turnout, with the possibility, distinct possibility existing, that for the first time in 50 years, there'll be more non-voters than voters. So this first debate tonight, and particularly the first, will be of immense importance in these two very important respects. I'd like to, first of all, talk about the political scene and to try to answer the question, can the GOP close the gap? Then I'd like to talk briefly about the economic mood of the nation. Thirdly, I'd like to talk about polling methods. I'm sure many of you have questions about polls. For example, how can so few people in a sample provide meaningful results? This is a question, incidentally, which seems to perturb Paul Harvey in particular. And I'd like next to talk about the mood of America a little bit. There's been a very dramatic change or shift in the mood of America in just the period of the last 12 months. And finally, I'd like to suggest ways that we as individuals might help to bring about a better society. But before I get underway, I'd like to remind myself of a warning Adlai Stevenson once gave when initiating a commencement address. He said, "It's my job today as speaker to talk. It's your job as the audience to listen. If you get through your job before I do, please feel free to get up and leave." Well, I'd like to address the question, is it all over for the GOP? Now, this sounds particularly inappropriate. What would the fact that the campaign has just been launched officially and in view of the fact that the first of the debates is tonight, which could be quite decisive, or it could have very little effect, as was the case in 1960. Actually, the effect of the 1960 debates was really to reaffirm the convictions of those who supported either man. Nixon people felt more strongly about Nixon, and Kennedy people more strongly about Kennedy. When we analyze the results of, the reaction to the TV debates, and we'll be in the field tomorrow with a full-scale national survey, we will be looking at the views of independents and the uncommitted in particular, because this will be a key area. Now, it'll be particularly important this year. The debates will play an important role, not only for clarification on issues and not only in terms of voter turnout, but because the vote this year is particularly soft, and I'll get to that a little bit later. Now, from a historical point of view, it's all over. Never in the history of polling has an underdog come on to win, an underdog of this dimension come on to win the election, not even in 1948. So President Ford will have to defy history in coming back. But of course, it's very, very possible indeed. In fact, I'd like to suggest some ways it could come about. But the record is rather bleak from the point of view of the GOP. Polling evidence based on the last six presidential elections shows that only once during this period has there been a pronounced shift in the choice of voters between July and November. And this was in 1964, when President Johnson's 32-point margin over Senator Barry Goldwater was reduced to a 22-point margin. Not much solace to the GOP, to be sure. But there have been very dramatic comebacks, to be sure. And all of us, and particularly pollsters, will remember 1948, when we said, and everybody thought, that Mr. Dewey would win. And of course, President Truman made a very dramatic comeback and won in the closing days of that campaign. He won for two basic reasons. There was a drop in farm prices in the Midwest, and a lot of normally Republican voters shifted over to Truman's side. And he won also because of the collapse of the third party support for Wallace, Henry Wallace. And actually, this is the typical pattern. The third party vote collapses in the closing days of a campaign traditionally in this century. So the history of the third party has not been very good in this century. But and our problem was basically, and I can get into this later, but the problem, the mistakes we made were stopping too soon. We stopped in mid-October. It didn't catch the last minute trend. Now we poll as close as we can to the election. And we caught the third party vote at a very high point. Henry Wallace's strength was at a much higher point at that stage in the campaign than it was than his actual vote. Similarly with, George Wallace in 1968, his vote was up around 22%, very, very high, the highest point a third party candidate had reached in this century. Very, very high in October of 1968, but in the election, as you know, he got 13.5%. So his vote collapsed in the closing days of the campaign. There have been other very dramatic comebacks, as well as President Truman's. Senator Hubert Humphrey's recovery in the latter part of the 1968 campaign was spectacular. He gained an average of about 200,000 votes per day during October, principally by sharply reducing the high rate of Democratic defection to Richard Nixon. Well, what specific trends or developments could help the GOP close the gap? Are there any bright spots in the horizon? Well, first of all, President Ford will have to win back his party defectors, those among Republicans who are still voting for Carter. Now, a Republican can ill afford to lose his own party members, as you know, because there are only 22% of Americans classify themselves as Republicans. And for a Republican to gain the White House, he must not only keep all of his own party followers in hand, but he must also win a big majority of independent voters in this country, and he also must win the support of some dissident Democrats. This has been the pattern. This is the case with President Nixon. This is the case with President Eisenhower. So President Ford has a major task in just getting his own followers behind him. I think he'll succeed in this. I think, at least from an historical point of view, party members on the GOP side tend to, in great overwhelming proportion, vote for their candidate. And President Ford at the present time does have a high defection rate. 14% of Republicans are voting for Mr. Carter at the present time in a trial heat, or what we call a trial heat or test election. The latest figures are 52-37, 52 for Mr. Carter nationwide and 37 for President Ford. In other words, it would translate into a landslide victory if the election were being held at this time. Now, President Ford has greatly reduced his defection rate, as a matter of fact, from around 25% prior to the GOP convention, and it was wide then, of course, as you would expect, because there was the strife within the GOP between Mr. Reagan and President Ford. But the president still has a high defection rate of 14%. Number two, another key factor which could change things and bring the GOP closer and maybe even give them a victory is Senator McCarthy's candidacy. Now, there are a lot of ifs here. If Senator McCarthy were to get his name on the ballot in virtually all states, then he would win at the present time about 6% of the national support. Well, if this 6% holds up, and as I indicated earlier, third party support tends to decline in the closing days or even collapse in the closing days of campaign, but if it holds up and he gets on the ballot in most states, then he could tip the balance to the GOP in a close election because he draws virtually all of his support away from Mr. Carter. Now, I can't present to you some findings on Mr. Maddox's potential vote getting at this particular time. You've caught me between surveys, but we are going into the field tomorrow, and by Sunday or Monday, we will have some figures on his popularity. Thirdly, there are some soft spots in Mr. Carter's support, as in the president's support, and if the president is able to win a large proportion of these voters who hold shallow choices or convictions, soft, if you will, then of course he could make it a much closer race. But of course it could work the other way. I think many political observers have felt that Mr. Carter's support is soft because he has such a wide lead. I think that's sort of perhaps a logical assumption, but the fact of the matter is, just to make matters worse for the GOP, President Ford has a greater proportion of soft supporters than does Mr. Carter. Number four, a difference could be made and the GOP could get closer if the Democrats fail seriously to get out the vote. Now, 2 years ago at this time, Republicans and Democrats were even in terms of registration level. But now, the Democrats are lagging behind the Republicans. Interest in the election is at a low point. At least, this goes back a couple of weeks. Now, it may be much higher on the eve of the debates, possibly, and the debates may stimulate great interest. We don't know, of course, at this point. The sad part is that, though, going back 2 weeks, that the proportion of young people who were registered to vote was only around 50%. This is ironic because, of course, you remember the tremendous struggle to get the vote for young people, 18 to 21, and now many young people seem to be forfeiting their opportunity. One basic reason, of course, is that the candidates have not generated a great deal of enthusiasm, at least compared to their predecessors, President Eisenhower, President Kennedy, and President Johnson for the first period in his office. Well, as I indicated earlier, hopefully the debates will ignite voter interest. Now, the candidate's position on issues, of course, is of tremendous importance. And of all issues, the most important to Americans are economic issues. And the hardy perennials in every presidential election, if you will, are peace and prosperity. If the nation's at peace, then prosperity is the key issue. Which candidate can help me economically, financially? This is what it really gets down to. And if we're countries at war, which country can get us out of war or prevent war? That's the question. At this particular time, the Democrats have a tremendously wide lead on the prosperity issue, tremendously wide, suggesting that people are not crediting President Ford with the economic recovery to any great extent. This has been the Democrats have owned this argument, the party of prosperity. The Republicans have tended to own the argument that wars start under Democratic administrations, while the Democrats counter that depressions come about under GOP administrations. The images of the GOP as the party of the rich and the privileged, and the Democratic Party as the party of the working man and the underprivileged, has remained among the electorate right to this day, and you feel the impact of it very definitely still. Now, another very key issue in this whole campaign, of course, is the whole issue of federal spending. Both men want to balance the budget, but the question is, how will the public view Mr. Carter on this issue? As a fiscal conservative, because he said he would guarantee a balanced budget before the end of his term, or as a big spender? He has, of course, committed himself to all the legislative goals in the party platform and has made proposals which will call for a tremendous outlay of money. Needless to say, the GOP is seeking to pin the liberal label on Mr. Carter in the South. In fact, I heard one Republican partisan label him as a born-again liberal. But this is a huge issue, this whole issue of federal spending. And interestingly, the mood of the electorate, both Republicans and Democrats, is indeed one of fiscal conservatism. In a survey taken not long ago, we found that an overwhelming majority of both Republicans and Democrats would like to see a law which would require the federal government to balance the budget each year. Now, as you may know, only three states don't have laws requiring the budget to be balanced. So this is a very key issue today. Certainly inflation is, certainly the concern over unemployment is. Concern over crime and lawlessness is a very, very big issue today. If you ask people what's the biggest problem in their cities or communities, crime and lawlessness is overwhelmingly the top problem cited. As a matter of fact, we have come up with some rather scary figures. A large majority of women are fearful, and this goes for rural areas, small towns, and so forth, are fearful of venturing out at night after dark in their neighborhoods. And one person in four nationwide during the 12-month period tested had been mugged, assaulted, or had his house broken into at least once during that period of time. We have the worst crime record in the entire world. And I say that because we've just completed a 58-nation study, the first global study ever undertaken, on fear of crime, but also religious beliefs and practices, attitudes towards education, housing, hopes, and fears. One of the most interesting findings, incidentally, to come from that survey was the finding we wanted to measure the relationship between poverty or economic problems and happiness. You still hear the thesis that there are some peoples in the world who have nothing but are happy, the happy savage sort of concept. Well, we can find absolutely no evidence of that in any part of the world. The less money people have, the more unhappy they are. It's very simple. There certainly are other imponderables too, such as unforeseen crises, international problems, and so forth, which, if occurring at the time of the election, could help the incumbent. One of the most vivid instances of the impact of events came in 1956, in the election of that year. Throughout 2 months of intensive campaigning by Dwight Eisenhower and Adlai Stevenson, voters hardly shifted in their views. Then came the Hungarian Revolution and the Suez Crisis in the closing days of the race, and there was a sharp upswing in support for Eisenhower. An estimated 3 to 4 million voters shifted to the GOP ticket in the last 10 days of that campaign. Now, of course, another major imponderable are the debates. And as I indicated earlier, this could have the effect of increasing voter interest and solidifying opinion and sharpening people's reaction to the candidates in terms of issues. Certainly the political story of 1976 has been the meteoric rise of Jimmy Carter. Well, he caught many of us unawares, including the Gallup poll. Back in December of last year, we drew up a list of 38 men and women who we thought, who had been talked about and who the public had suggested as possible presidential candidates. We left one man off, Mr. Carter. And needless to say, we put him on shortly thereafter. Now, there's been much speculation as to the basis of his appeal. Well, it's easy to figure out why his tremendous appeal during the primary period and subsequently. Now, I'm not speaking for the last 2 or 3 weeks, because I don't have survey data for that. But prior to that time, his political philosophy as perceived by the public matched their own. And this is very key, obviously, because elections are won in the center of the electorate in terms of political ideology, right in the middle or slightly to the left, slightly to the right. The extremes, accounting for only about 15% extreme right and extreme left, do not decide elections. It's really right in the middle there. So all candidates, you notice, will try desperately to shift over toward the center, move back and forth till they get into the position they feel they can win most votes. Certainly, Mr. Carter's a second point. Certainly, Mr. Carter's fiscal conservatism sat well with voters when we conducted the survey. Now, perhaps views are changing on this. I can't report to you at this point. An anti-Washington mood is working in his favor. The voters are very turned off about politics and politicians. Watergate, of course, didn't help matters. The criminality surrounding that situation was very upsetting to voters and very discouraging to them. So they were in the mood for a fresh face, somebody who would talk about trust in government and somebody who would talk about Christian virtues. He was a breath of fresh air on the scene at that point. Now, again, I'm going back before 2 or 3 weeks, because perhaps the situation has changed. Some political observers feel that Mr. Carter has said things which are not consistent with his earlier remarks. So I just want to point out the interviewing time on this. Now, certainly another very important factor in his meteoric rise are his religious beliefs. 1/3 of all Americans say they are born-again Christians. This, and 1/2 of all Protestants say they have been born again or have had a conversion experience and committed themselves to Jesus Christ. This is a remarkable figure indeed. In fact, we find fundamentalism very strong in this country. 1/2 of all Protestants hold a literal interpretation of the Bible and accept it word for word. That, I think, will be surprising to you. Many Catholics have had a born-again experience. 1/5 say they've had a born-again experience. Now, many, you may have asked the question, and perhaps you know it, why the evangelical faiths have grown at such a spectacular rate, but the mainline churches have not. Well, one key and obvious reason is that the evangelical faiths have more salesmen in the field, if you will. They do a great deal more witnessing than do the mainline traditional denominations. Now, some commentators have expressed surprise that Jimmy Carter, a born-again Christian, could fare so well in what they describe as a largely agnostic and secularized country. But the fact of the matter is, Americans are extraordinarily religious. We see this in this international study, which indicates that Americans are the most religious people in the world among the industrial nations in terms of the importance they place on religion, and in terms of belief in God, in terms of belief in an afterlife. Indeed, it appears that Christianity is in real trouble, or is in trouble, in certain Western European countries, where belief in an afterlife and in belief in God have declined rather markedly over the last 25 years, while these levels have remained constant in the United States. Mr. Carter might be said to have a built-in power base with Baptists. Baptists lean, they're more conservative in political ideology than the country as a whole, and yet they lean heavily, 3-1 to Mr. Carter. So there is a lot of support among, you might describe this as a power base of sorts. As a matter of fact, it's a very large political voter block, accounting for 20% of the populace. You hear a lot of talk about the Catholic vote, but you will now hear a lot of talk about the Baptist vote, because there are almost as many Baptists as Catholics in this country. Well, I'd like to turn briefly now to the public's mood regarding the economy. As I indicated, inflation and unemployment are the top concerns of Americans at this time. For the first time that we've been polling since 1935, in the first election, the American electorate is concerned chiefly about economic problems, not questions relating to war and peace. The top concern at the present time continues to be inflation, followed by unemployment. Public optimism regarding the future has, economic future has climbed markedly, or did climb markedly, during the first months of this year, but has tended to level off in the subsequent months. Your reaction might be, well, so what? What does it matter what the public thinks? The fact of the matter is, the average person is something of an expert, if you will, in judging what's happening economically, because he's close to the scene, he knows what's going on economically in his own household, his community, at his job, so forth. So if you take the views of the public in the aggregate, it really it presents something very important, represents something important. As a matter of fact, the American people have had a better record than the nation's economists. As a case in point, the beginning of 1974, when all leading economists were saying that the situation would improve, the economic situation during that year, the public overwhelmingly said things would turn down, get worse, and unfortunately, they did. Now, while one might describe the average citizen as something of an economic expert, there are, of course, dramatic exceptions. We asked one young housewife to define the European common market, and she said, well, that's where the average person goes to shop. As a matter of fact, Americans could probably use a primer on economics, and I think you may be amused by these definitions of forms of government courtesy of Britain's Financial Times. Perhaps we have something to learn from Mother England, according to this particular article. Well, the definition of socialism, according to this article, you have two cows, and you give one to your neighbor. Communism, you have two cows, the government takes both of them and gives you the milk. Fascism, you have two cows, the government takes both of them and sells you milk. Nazism, you have two cows, the government takes both of them and shoots you. Bureaucracy, you have two cows, the government takes both of them, shoots one of them, milks the other, and pours the milk down the drain. And capitalism, you have two bulls, you sell one of them, you have two cows, you sell one of them and buy a bull. Now, I'd like to turn to a brief discussion of our methods at the present time. And certainly, one of the areas which is very puzzling to people is the area of sampling, of course. How can so few people represent the views of the entire nation, 144 million adults, 18 and over? We interview merely 1,500 people in a typical survey. Actually, we could interview 500 and have very good projectable data based on merely 500. Well, the point is, of course, to make sure that you have a representative sample. And the best way to make sure of that is to construct your sample so that each person has an equal chance of being selected. Now, let me tell you about a hypothetical situation or give you an example of how the law of probabilities would operate in the selection of individuals. Suppose there were a giant telephone book or list of 144 million adults in this country. Well, we would divide 1,500 into that list. There's nothing magical about 1,500. It's just a figure which provides breakdowns and yet and accurate data. It meets the requirements of the laws of probability, provides projectable data. We could triple or quadruple that number and still not greatly improve our cut down our margin of error. But suppose we had this list. We divided 1,500 into it and then interviewed that person, kept the same interval exactly, of course. We would have a perfect sample. You couldn't improve upon it. The only thing you'd have to live with is built-in sampling error, which exists, of course, when you're dealing with samples as a whole, of course. But there's no such list, and even if there were, you'd have to go to 1,500 different places around the country. So it would not be feasible. But we have the same effect if you deal with blocks rather than individuals. And in other words, if 70% of the households are blocks in this country, or you could possibly describe it as blue collar, 30% white collar, then the sample is constructed with the chance so that the chances of the blue collar household arising 70 times out of 100 and the white collar 30 times out of 100. So the principle still obtains. The whole process rests firmly on the laws of probability. And we gain assurance that indeed our sample has been a probability sample when we look at the background characteristics of the people whom we've interviewed, and we see that their characteristics match up within a percent or two of the actual of census data. So gives us assurance that indeed our sample has been randomly selected. Now, as you can imagine, we've polled on a tremendous number of topics, including sex. We asked one young housewife how she felt about the double standard in matters of sex, and her reply was, "Well, I'm all in favor of it. Standards should be twice as high where sex is concerned." We've even done our bit for the bicentennial. Recently, we asked a representative sample of the American people to tell us what important event occurred in the year 1776. I wish we hadn't asked the question. We found that 3 in 10 either didn't know or gave an incorrect answer. And to make matters worse, the British Gallup poll found only 5% of the people of that country attaching any significance to the year 1776. We spend a good deal of our time, of course, explaining our methods, but we continue to get, of course, less than adulatory fan mail. A letter which we received recently said, "Dear Mr. Gallup, on what do you bias your opinions?" Another of our critics wrote saying, "The Gallup poll is a fraud on the American people, probably run by the CIA. And still another addressed his letter to George Gallup, American Institute of his own opinion, and said, "May I suggest that you get on your little pony and gallop away?" Sometimes we seek to measure levels of awareness and knowledge among the American people with amusing results. To one person, the plebiscite is a bug. Another person thought that nostalgia is a nasal condition. One person thought that cyclamates who live together should get married. In a series of questions dealing with the images of candidates, one person thought that Nelson Rockefeller was, quote, sincere, whether he means it or not. Now, I'd like to talk briefly about the mood of the public today. Within the last 12 months, we have seen a very sharp trend or shift to the right, that is toward a more conservative point of view. Indeed, the cumulative evidence would seem to indicate an end to what has been described as the era of permissiveness. We see this change in mood in, first of all, the trend among parents of school-aged children in favor of a return to basics in the curriculum and to stricter discipline. Two, in the views on issues such as the death penalty, which is a good barometer of left-right sentiment in this country, we find support at an all-time high, support for the death penalty. Three, we find it in the desire among Democrats and Republicans alike to reduce federal spending. And four, we see this shift, of course, from other years in the candidates. This has not been the year of the liberal, to be sure. Well, Americans are apprehensive about many aspects of their society today. Surveys show increased concern regarding the standards of honesty of people. The public reports a serious lack of confidence in key American institutions. Only about half the public express a high level of confidence in the free enterprise system. Indeed, there is a very strong anti-business mood on campus today, perhaps deriving from the fact, as we've discovered in surveys, that many students across the country grossly exaggerate the amount of profits made by the typical corporation and grossly underestimate the amount of taxes paid. But we do find only about half the public expressing a high level of confidence in the free enterprise system. We find widespread frustration over the many unsolved local and political problems. Many Americans feel they have little say in the direction the nation is taking. We lack heroes, with at least half the people unable to name a man or woman they especially admire. Well, despite this concern over certain aspects of American society, the overwhelming majority of Americans are revealing an increasingly upbeat mood and express confidence in the nation. And they do so for three reasons, and these are the reasons they give, the public gives. First of all, the nation has had the resources and strength to survive difficult periods in the past. Two, Americans have the capacity for self-criticism and change. Three, the American people realize there is much they can do as individuals to bring about a better society. Indeed, there is an explosion of voluntarism at all levels of society today. And I'd like to suggest a few ways that we can make a contribution as individuals. And fortunately, in this country, we can make this contribution. We can change things around. Certainly, we can play an important part in voting. It may be that this fall that the candidates will be chosen by a minority of the electorate, that the majority will not have had a voice in the selection of the nation's leadership, which is rather incredible, an incredible situation. America has long had the worst voting record of any major democracy in the world. Americans are badly out of tune with the political system. Only about half of U.S. citizens can name their own congressman. Far fewer know where he stands on issues. Part of the reason for this political apathy is, at the present time, a lack of enthusiasm for the candidates relative to earlier years, but also because there are many aspects of the electoral process which are very upsetting and puzzling to the American people. As a matter of fact, if left up to the U.S. public, the whole electoral process would be completely revamped. They would do away with the primary system and have one nationwide primary. They'd shorten the campaigns. The campaigns, incidentally, are much shorter in Great Britain. They would have the vice president selected by the public. They would do away with the Electoral College. They would put tighter limits on campaign spending. Indeed, if there's a root cause of many of our problems in the area of politics, it is the tremendous amount of money it takes to run for office. Very few people, young people, want to run for political office. One, because of the tremendous price tag. Secondly, because of the abuse heaped on politicians. But as a matter of fact, we did find that in a poll of people listed in Who's Who, that 25% of people, and these people represent people of all different backgrounds, of course, 25% would run for senator if money were not a factor. Now, here's an awful lot of wasted talent, an awful lot, people representing many different fields. The interest is there, but they're not about to get involved in politics. So it's understandable why the public is cynical. How many times have you heard a politician say, my opponent has a very good point there, and I agree with him? How many times have you heard them say, I know my financial backers won't like this, but this is the way I feel? How many times have you heard them say, I don't know the answer to that, but I'm going to find out? How many times have you heard them say, we're behind, but we're going to come on strong? How many times have you heard them say what they feel, even though that's not the right audience? And you see that right up to the present time. And so no wonder voters are cynical. Voters are not gullible. Voters are very cynical about the process right now. And indeed, there must be some radical changes in our electoral process, in our campaign spending, and in limiting the terms of office of senators and representatives, with the idea that politics should be a period of service and not a career. It's a period of service in Great Britain, for example. And a person takes time off from his other job to serve the country with very little money. But then he doesn't have to desperately try to stay in office and get huge sums of money to get reelected and spend half his time in office trying to get reelected because he has another job to go back to. He's not, this is one of the key problems in this country, and I think it's safe to say that the public will not really get involved in politics until they see many of these long sought for changes carried out. Well, certainly this is a good time, though, despite these difficulties, for women to get involved in politics. The public has never been more receptive to women entering politics. One of the most dramatic changes we found in public opinion is in terms of the attitudes of the American people toward women running for president and other high political office. In fact, the proportion has gone from about a third who said they would not object to voting for a woman to well over three quarters of all people. There still is considerable bias, if you will, and this comes more often from women than men. Women are their own worst enemy in terms of gaining leadership roles. I've always liked President Eisenhower's dictum, politics should be the part-time profession of every citizen. Now, certainly another area where we can make an important contribution is in giving careful consideration to what we plan to do in life, not only when you're in college, but when you're out of college, and another job even. One of our most interesting findings, I think, is the one, and perhaps it's a little frightening, is the one which shows that half of all people say that they would go into another line of work if they had it to do over again. So here is half the populace not really happy in what they're doing, just doing it very grudgingly. And that's a sad state of affairs, really. I mean, of course it's inevitable, and people are very happy to get any job they can, indeed. But it is unfortunate that fully half are not happy in their jobs. So certainly this is an area where which we can make a great contribution, figuring out what fields you should go into, preparing carefully for the various fields, of course. Certainly we can make a contribution in joining local committees to deal with such problems as traffic, pollution, problems related to schools, crime, so forth. As a matter of fact, 6 in 10 Americans say they'd work on committees to deal with local problems if they were asked and if they could be assured that their work would be meaningful and that they would be recognized in some fashion, not monetarily. So there are an awful lot of people willing to do the work, and the average person would give 4 hours per week on the average. So there's a tremendous manpower potential and womanpower potential here. Of course, many people are indeed working on problems in this country, and voluntarism, as you know, has been historically an American trait. And indeed, there are some who feel that voluntarism is the best hope for this country. Now, we can certainly make a great contribution in keeping ourselves informed, reflecting on the issues beyond just reading about them. Our surveys indicate a serious lack of knowledge about the nation's history, about our political system, about our economic system. The level of formal education has grown dramatically since the mid-30s, but book reading has not kept a pace. In addition, the rate of illiteracy and functional illiteracy in this country is frightening. It is estimated that one-fifth of the populace fall into these categories. And no wonder the problem of illiteracy has been called the greatest social problem of our times. Many of the nation's problems are centered among those groups who are least educated and therefore the most frustrated and have the highest rate of illiteracy. Indeed, there are those who feel that the high rate of illiteracy or functional illiteracy threatens the survival of democracy. Thomas Jefferson once said, "A nation cannot be both ignorant and free." I think religion is playing a very important part in this. We recently conducted a survey in the greater Dayton area, Dayton, Ohio. We picked that area because it's a barometer or weather vane area for the whole country. And we found that people's beliefs about God had a very important effect on their day-to-day lives in terms of an inspiration and in terms of restraint. Many people refrain from actual crime because of their religious beliefs. So fortunately in this country, we have a strong religious tradition as well as a tradition, unfortunately, of crime, too, of high crime. But certainly there could be no better form of volunteer work than to help youngsters to learn to read or to raise their level of reading. Communication with leaders. This, of course, is tremendously important. Are we contacting our nation's leaders? Are we writing the editors of our newspapers, our senators, our representatives? All too often, a legislator will hear primarily from special interest groups, while the voters representing the majority public interest remain silent. We like to think of the polling process as giving the public an opportunity to make their views known to the leaders of our country. We like to think of the Gallup poll as a sort of ongoing referendum on the issues of the day. We do not have a referendum on issues nationwide, and the elections are often misread as meaning a mandate for this or that. In fact, they usually are. So it is very important, we feel, to have a constant measurement of what the public, not only the majority, of course, but minority groups in the country, what they want, need, what they know about certain areas, what their hopes are and their fears. As a matter of fact, the four decades of polling have provided ample evidence that the common man is well equipped to pass judgment on the great issues and legislation of his time. Whereas his stock of knowledge may be rather low, his common sense quotient, if you will, is very high. Over this period of four decades, the public has consistently been ahead of Congress in supporting many proposals in such areas as national defense, health, and social welfare. Are we helping to build a better mood in this country? Are those of us in the area of communication, politicians, public relations practitioners, advertising people, pollsters, journalists, TV commentators, teachers, are we trying to restore a mood of confidence in this country, an upbeat mood? Are we trying to help Americans reach out for a higher sense of themselves? Are we putting things in perspective, pointing out that some of the severe problems in this nation are not crises at all, but challenges confronting a world which is rapidly outgrowing certain institutions and old technologies? Are we trying to restore a balanced account of life, stressing the positive aspects of society as well as the negative aspects? Are we pointing out the monumental achievements of our society, the fantastic strides in science and medicine, the incredible rise in the standard of living, the reduction in infant mortality, the reduction in poverty, the widespread availability of a college education, and now a renewed dedication to the ideal of service, to volunteerism?